We are in Hebrews chapter 12 tonight. There are actually two classes remaining. We have tonight, and then next week is actually the last class of this particular session that we are in. So tonight in here we'll be finishing in chapter 12. Next week we'll be looking at chapter 13 as we finish our study of the book of Hebrews. I hope that this has been a profitable study for you of a key book that we have in the New Testament, key book of the Bible that helps us to draw the entirety of the Bible together, to put it in a perspective and a context in which God intended for that old covenant and that new covenant to have as they work together in bringing about God's plan to save man. And so here's a book that elevates Christ to be superior in every way, encourages these Christians who are on the verge of falling away, these Christians who are on the verge of returning back to their old roots of Judaism, and says, don't depart from God by doing that. Don't lose your salvation by doing that. He urges them to remain faithful and does that by telling them what they have in Christ, how superior Christ is in every way. And what we've been doing these last couple weeks is looking at the closing chapters of the book, which are the real practical section of the book. This is where he gets down to the application. Those first 9.5 chapters is where he was very doctrinal in his approach in presenting Christ and doing it in such a way that very systematically he's presenting Christ in all ways as being superior in Christ's covenant and his sacrifice and his blood and his high priesthood and all of that being superior than all that was under Judaism. But starting in chapter 10, verse 19, very practical application. What do we do about it as Christians? I want you to turn back to the end of chapter 10, and then we're coming right to chapter 12. But I want us to be reminded of where he is in the closing verses of chapter 10, because these are key verses that help us in our study of chapter 12. Chapter 10, verse 36, he says, "You have need of what? You have need of endurance." Key word in chapter 12 is endurance. He says, the closing verses of chapter 10, you have need of endurance. When we get over to chapter 12, that's a key word. You have need of endurance so that after you've done the will of God, you may receive the promise. Verse 39, we are not of those who draw back to destruction or perdition, but we are those who have faith to the saving of the soul. You have need of endurance. What's involved in that? Having faith in God. What's involved in having faith? A faith that is obedient and active in doing the will of God. And then we have Hebrews chapter 12. Not just randomly God throwing in here 40 verses, but purposefully God helping them to see what is faith, helping them to understand a visual picture of God's, not just description, but God's demonstration of what true faith is, that true faith is an obedient faith, and that's what we read in chapter 11. Now come to chapter 12. First word you have in chapter 12 is what? Therefore what? Therefore, based upon all that we've just read for the last 44 verses, the 40 verses of chapter 11, the closing verses of chapter 10, therefore, since we understand we have need of endurance, and now we have been given this demonstration of those who truly did endure, therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. We looked at these first couple of verses in the closing seconds of the class last week. But what he is doing in this chapter, and really in these last two chapters, is he has been presenting Christ as being superior. Now what he's doing in his last two chapters is saying, let me talk to you about the Christian life. And let me tell you about how the Christian life is superior in every way to any other life that you would live, and especially to that life that would be involved in being living under Judaism. And so he's going to present Christianity as being superior, and he's going to urge them on to endurance. He's going to urge them on to steadfastness. So how does he do that? He reminds them, look at those who have gone before us. That's that cloud of witnesses. And it's not that these The word witnesses there does not mean that these individuals are watching you. Does not mean that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are in heaven watching you. That's not the kind of witness that's being discussed here. Those who are in heaven are not privy to those things that are happening here on earth. They're not viewing those things that are happening here on earth. But instead, they are witnesses of, they are evidence of what it means to live a life of faith. We're surrounded by them. In these examples that he's given, not just in this chapter, but throughout the Old Testament. And so since we have them as an example, you see the words, let us, that's the practical part of this. Let us lay aside every weight, any weight, all weights, any encumbrance or burden, and let us lay aside every sin, whatever sin there is that's clinging to you, whatever sin there is that is tenaciously grabbing a hold of you, you got to get rid of it because you've got to be able to run. You can't run when you have weights, when you have things clinging to you, you got to get rid of them because the Christian has a responsibility to run. He's been given a race to run, and he's got to run that race with endurance. You know, sometimes the Christian race can be difficult. And maybe you would say, no, that's not true. A lot of times the Christian race can be difficult. Christian race has its ups and downs. Christian race is not always on level ground. Sometimes it's going uphill. Sometimes it is on level ground. Sometimes you're running downhill and it's pretty easy. Sometimes it's in the middle of a storm and it's raining. Sometimes you're in darkness. You're in uncertainty. And then sometimes it's in times of peace. You know the Christian life. That's what he's getting ready to describe here. And he says, you've got a race that has been set before you. Remember what they said in chapter 10. You have need of endurance. Chapter 12, verse 1. When you're going to run this race, it's a marathon. What do you need to do? You need to run it with endurance. You need to learn how to maintain your pace. You need to learn how to get rid of those things that would get in the way. And you need to keep your eye on the goal. Look in verse 2. We have this race. Chapter 6, you remember chapter 6 when it talked about Jesus who is our forerunner and he entered into the presence behind the veil in the closing verses of chapter 6? Here's Jesus looking unto Jesus, the author. Anybody have a different word than the word author there? The pioneer, the source, he's the leader. He's the one who has led the way of faith. He's the leader of our faith. So he's the one who started it. He's the one who got it moving. He is our pioneer and leader in this. But not just that, he's the author and the what? The finisher, the perfecter, the one who's going to bring us to the goal. So when that idea of bringing us to the goal means when we're running this race, we're not running it by ourselves. We are looking unto Jesus. That doesn't mean he's in some far off, you know, he's 10 miles down the road and I can barely see him. Yes, he's right at the right hand of God, as the end of verse 2 is going to tell us. But being at the right hand of God, does that mean that he's not right here next to me too? He's right here next to me too in this race. This idea of looking, the Greek word that's used here for looking means I look away from everything else in order that I might look at one thing. I intentionally take my eyes away from all of these other distractions and place them solely on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him. Notice in verse 1, we have a race set before us. Verse 2, Jesus had a joy set before him. What was that joy? The cross. The joy of the exaltation that would come because of the cross. We have need of endurance. What did Jesus do on the cross? He endured the cross, despising the shame, in order that he might be where he is now, sitting at the right hand of the throne of God. And so here we are, urged to steadfastness, reminded of those who have gone before us, and reminded of Jesus as our perfect example. And then he starts in verse 3. To continue this admonition of steadfastness, but he's going to let them know that there's difficult days in being a Christian. There's struggles, there's challenges. In fact, there's going to be persecutions. And so it's not that he's trying to tell them Christ is superior. Christianity is a superior life. You need to come over and live this life, but not tell them what's involved. They already know what's involved, but he's going to remind them this is a difficult life. Verse 3, for consider him who endured. That's the third time we've seen that word endure in this chapter. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself. Did Jesus endure hostility? How much of it did he deserve? How much of it did he have coming? Zero. You remember those kids in school that they just, when they got in trouble, you said, well, they had it coming. I mean, and some of them, they had it coming for a long time. Yep. Saw that one coming. You know, how much of Jesus' trouble did he have coming to him? How much of it did he deserve?
Zero.
Not a bit. So he says, consider him. When hostility came from these sinners, what did he do? The word endure means that you bear up under it. It doesn't mean that you just cower. The word endure doesn't mean, well, I just cower and I wait for it to go away. That's not endure. That some people might define that as endure. Well, I'll sit over in the corner and I'll be real quiet and be real still and maybe all of this bad stuff will go away. That's not enduring. That's just sitting. Jesus and what he calls it, we get up underneath this burden. Consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. Do Christians endure hostilities? Do we have people who mistreat us? We have troublesome times? Could we become weary and discouraged? Could we lose heart? Could we get so frustrated by how things are going, we just say, you know what? I just don't know if I can do it anymore. Did God know that? Yeah, so what does he say? Look at Jesus. Look at what he did. Look at how he went through it, and for what? He did it all for us. But he says to them in verse 4, you have not yet resisted to bloodshed. Other people had. Other Christians had. But he says, you have not yet resisted unto bloodshed, striving against sin. Here you are as Christians. You're going to go through hard times. You haven't had to deal with bloodshed yet. But notice that word yet. What does that mean? It's coming. He's not telling them, well, you know, you all haven't had to deal with bloodshed and you never will. Is that what he's saying? No. You got the word yet there. It is coming. Well, then why stay? If you know bloodshed is coming, get out of town, right? Take off. Why would I stay here if I know that persecution's coming? Why would I stay here if I know that bloodshed is coming? Verse 5, if that's where you are, you have forgotten. Is there one translation that says completely forgotten? I don't remember what translation that is. You have completely forgotten something. You have completely forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as sons. And then this quotation, the middle of verse 5 down through verse 6, is this quotation that says from the Old Testament, but now is saying to us as Christians, my son, do not despise, New King James, King James, the chastening of the Lord. Do not despise the chastening of the Lord. What's a different word than the word chastening that you have? Discipline. What was the other one? Correction. Somebody got something else? Say it again. Regard not lightly. That means you got to take this seriously. You got to take this seriously. What are we taking seriously? That God has warned us. He's given us an exhortation. Do not despise, do not take lightly the discipline of the Lord. Well, hang on. What are you talking about, discipline? That's not a very nice thing to talk, discipline. Well, would you prefer chastening? I mean, we don't use the word chastening as much as we use and understand the word discipline. And somebody has the word correction. What are you talking about, the correction of the Lord? I just, you know, he's a God of love. You know, that means he does only good things. Yes, both of those statements are true. God is a God of love, and he does only do good things. Is there discipline that could still fit within that? Have you known any fathers or mothers who were individuals of love, who only did good things, and yet there was discipline involved in those relationships? Trudy?
I was going to say, just like a father or mother disciplines their child, that's the way the Lord does.
Absolutely. And that's exactly where God is going to go in this passage when we get down into verses 7 and 8. Now, let's as we read through this, and I know we've read through this a number of times before, let's remember that as this is talking about the fact you have not yet resisted unto bloodshed, verse 4. Your persecution has not yet risen to that level. Here are Christians who are suffering persecution. And that would have been one of the reasons, perhaps, that they're ready to back away from Christ. You know, I didn't come to this to be persecuted. Here they are suffering persecution. Is God the one who is persecuting them? Is God the one who is... Was God the one who brought all of the calamity upon Job? Is God the one who did that? No, he didn't. But what? He allowed it to happen. So, does God allow certain things to come into our lives? Why would he do that? Why wouldn't he stop? If he loves me, here's the statement. If God really loves me, he'd stop this. If God really loves me, he wouldn't let that happen to me. If God really loved those children, if God really loved those people, you heard these statements? If God really loved these people, God wouldn't let that happen. Okay. Is there perhaps a purpose behind this? That God would allow certain things to happen? Now, it's a whole nother discussion to talk about why people suffer. And to talk about the fact that there are factors involved in this world that man has put into place, and now we are suffering some of the consequences of some of those things that man has done. That's a whole other discussion. That's not what's being discussed here. But he says to them, do not despise the discipline of the Lord. The word chastening, the word discipline there is just a word that was used in parenting that would talk about training a child with instruction, discipline. Nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord does what? He chastens who? Verse 6, who does he chasten? Who does he discipline? Oh, the people that he loves. For whom the Lord loves, he disciplines. And scourges, allows afflictions and sufferings, and scourges every son whom he receives. Why do Christians experience hardship? Well, one thing he gives us in verse 5 is sometimes Christians experience hardship because it is an opportunity for God to instruct us, to teach us, to correct us. Sometimes Christians suffer hardship in verse 6 because God loves us. Sometimes we don't think that way, but isn't that the truth? Sometimes God allows us to suffer hardships in order that we might be reminded that we are his children. Look in verse 7. If you endure chastening, that's the New King James. Is it New American Standard that says it is for discipline that you endure? Something like that. You are enduring for what purpose? For discipline? For chastening? If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. Did you see the word sons in here? Look back in verse 5. You have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to who? Sons. In the quotation it says, my son. Look at the end of the quotation, the end of verse 6. He scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, verse 7, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? We have a unique relationship with God, and that we are called His children. And as His child, as His son, as His daughter, I can look at Him as my father. And if I am going through trials and hardships and afflictions and sufferings, God says, you need to be reminded of something. You've got a special relationship with God as His son. An interesting statement in verse 8. But if you are without chastening, what if I'm not going through some time of discipline? If you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, and he brings in this element that Trudy was mentioning, verse 9. Furthermore, we have had human fathers who disciplined us, who corrected us. Is that still true today? Maybe getting less true as the generations go on. We have had human fathers who corrected and disciplined us. And what did we do in return? Oh, we hated them. We despised them. What does this say we did? We paid them respect. Is that true? Did you all grow up in a generation where your father corrected, disciplined you? Did that build respect for him? Might have built fear. Might have built fear. Did that fear give way to respect? Eva? Well, you know, sometimes it may have been that we were scared of our dad. But you know, sometimes, if that's where we are, maybe we needed to be scared of our dad. Maybe we were living in such a way that we needed a good scare. But when you look back, do you have respect for the man who tried to help you to grow up in the way that you should go? We had human fathers, he said. They corrected us. What did we do? We paid them respect. Shall we not much more? How many times does he use this lesser to greater argument in this book? Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? What if we respect God? We'll live. That's one of the benefits of correction and discipline, is learning to respect God and live. Verse 10, for they indeed for a few days chastened us. Might have felt like it was forever and ever that they were spanking us. But it was only for a few days that they disciplined us. And they, why did the fathers do it? Because it seemed best to them in how to bring us up. Well, why does God chasten us? Why does God discipline us? But He for our profit, that we may be partakers of His holiness. Why do we suffer trials and tribulations and persecutions and afflictions? Sometimes it's done for our profit, that we might become partakers of His holiness. And of course, verse 11, no chastening seems to be joyful for the present. Who would say they enjoy going through those things? But they're painful. They're sorrowful. Nevertheless, afterward, when you go through those things, what comes out the other side? The peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been exercised or trained by it. God's not the one who persecutes us, but God is able to use that persecution for our good to develop within us greater character. And we only have 10 minutes, so I won't go over to Romans chapter 5, but you might go over and look at Romans chapter 5 and even write maybe out in the margin next to this, Romans chapter 5, particularly about verses 2, 3, and 4, to talk about here's where I am, here's what I'm going through, but what's the outcome? Can I become stronger? Can I come out the side a person of character? a person of discipline, someone who is more determined to live right and to do right, yeah. And therefore, did that persecution have a purpose? Dirk? You know, it comes in all sorts of paths, different ways, different purposes, different reasons. You know, sometimes it comes because of something we have done. Sometimes it comes because of something that others have done. You know, here they are living in a culture, and here we are on the verge of living in a culture. But they were living in a culture where they were being persecuted. Why? Some of them, because they were a Christian. Because they had put on Christ, they were suffering persecution. And would that be something that somebody would say, you know what, enough is enough? And he's saying, look at the whole of it. Come out the other side of this stronger and more fruitful and more righteous than you were before. Brad? Well, think about, and we always go and talk about Job, but think about Job. Did Job have a relationship with God before all of that transpired with him? So much a relationship with God that God looked at him and said, you know, I don't have anybody else like him on the earth. And to take Brad's analogy, did Job know the Word of God? To whatever extent he could know the Word of God, that he knew God. How did he come to know God? He had built a relationship with God through God revealing himself to Job. And yet, what happened? He still suffered tremendously in this life. But what? What allowed him to remain steady? Even when he was questioning God, even when he was saying, why me, why this, or you, what caused him to never turn his back completely on God and say, enough is enough? His faith and trust in God. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. And that's the building of faith here. So, but when you get to verse 12, he says, now listen, when you're going through this, don't put your soul focus on you. Don't just say, oh, woe is me. How bad is it for me? Guess what? You're not the only one going through these things. Therefore, verse 12, since the idea here is, since it's necessary, obviously, to go through these things, then let's react properly. And let's strengthen the hands which hang down. Y'all ever seen a boxing match? Y'all ever seen those? Marion has. Horizontal Holland. She watched a lot of those. You ever seen a boxing match that goes 12 and 13 and 14 rounds? You ever seen those guys have a hard time bringing up their hands? They're tired. That's the imagery. That's the exact imagery here is of a boxer. He is worn out. What are we supposed to do? Are there Christians who get worn out? Strengthen the hands that hang down. The feeble knees, the knees that are about weak and lame and paralyzed, help to strengthen those feeble knees and help people to be able to walk a straight path. Make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be dislocated. Here's somebody who is struggling. Here's somebody that's hurting. Here's somebody that can't even pick up their hands. But don't let them become somebody who's just completely out of place, completely dislocated and leaves the church and leaves the faith. Help them through this. Galatians 6 would say, help them bear the burden. Here it's saying, strengthen their hands, help them straighten their paths, and help them to endure these things so that they can be healed. Verse 14, pursue peace with all people and holiness. You know why? Because if you don't, you will not see the Lord. Looking carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God. The Greek word there for looking carefully comes from what we would know, and perhaps a word that you have heard, the noun form of this would be episkopos. You've heard that word used in sermons about elders. An elder is an episkopos. He is an overseer. That's the word that's used here. But this verse is not addressed to elders. This verse is addressed to Christians. Are elders, do elders have the responsibility to oversee the flock? Yeah, we're going to see that when we get to chapter 13. But guess who else has the responsibility to look out among the flock for those who are hurting? We all do. Everybody is told, look carefully, open your eyes, lest anyone... And that was a key word back in chapter 3 and verse 4, in chapter 4. Lest any... Who can fall short of God's grace? Who can fall away? Anybody. So look and do what you can, lest anybody fall short of the grace of God. Lest any root of bitterness spring up. You know what a root of bitterness can do to a church? It can divide it. It can destroy it. Can one root of bitterness... breed and lead to another root of bitterness? Can one foul attitude lead to another foul attitude? Can one person who is angry at the elders lead to another person who is angry with the elders? What happens? You get one root of bitterness that springs up, and that can lead to another, and God says, nip it in the bud. Don't let this contaminate and destroy the church, lest there be any fornicator, lest there be any profane person like Esau. And he talks about how, think about what Esau did. Sold his birthright for a bowl of soup. Did he miss the big picture? Here's somebody so focused on the right here, right now, what I want. What did he do? Lost sight of what really mattered. God says, don't lose sight of what really matters. What really matters is everybody enduring and making it to heaven. Verse 18. For you have, and here's where he's going to, this is his final contrast between the old law and the new law. This is kind of his grand finale, you might call it, to say, here's the final thing, the final contrast I'm going to draw for you between these two covenants. You have not come to the mountain, to Mount Sinai. You haven't come to Mount Sinai that can be touched and burned with fire, blackness, darkness. Everything that's happening in Exodus 19 and 20 that happened at Mount Sinai, he says, that's not where you have come. Verse 22, you have come to Mount Zion, not Mount Sinai. You have come to Mount Zion. Somebody says, I don't know what Mount Zion is. Guess what? He's going to tell you. Look at how many times you got the little word to, T-O, all throughout this verse and the next couple of verses. He's going to tell you when Christians have come to Mount Zion, and we already know what that is because we sing a song. It says, we're marching to Zion. Oh, okay, we know what that is because we got a song about it. Maybe they did too, okay? We've come to Mount Zion. What is that? It's the city of the living God. You know where that is, right? It would come to Mount Zion. Who is that? To an innumerable company of angels. Where do the angels live? I know where we've come. Verse 23. We've come to Mount Zion. What's that? To the general assembly and church of the firstborn. We've come to the church. But where is the church? Registered in heaven. We've come to Mount Zion. Well, what's that? We've come to God, who's the judge of all. We've come to Mount Zion. Well, what's that? We've come to the spirits of just men made perfect. We've come to the realm where those who have been faithful and departed have gone. We have come to Mount Zion. Verse 24, where's that? We've come to Jesus, mediator of the new covenant. We've come to the blood of sprinkling. And so here he says, look, you seriously want to go back to Mount Sinai? You go back to Mount Sinai, you can experience everything that you got in verses 18 and 19 up there. Or you can come over and live for Christ. And living for Christ, you can come to heaven. You can come with direct access to God. You can come behind the veil. You can enter in behind the veil. You can come into the most holy place. All of those imageries that he used throughout this book, you can come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, where God is, where Jesus is, where the angels are, where the departed faithful of days gone by are. That's where faithful Christians, not just where they go when they leave this earth, that's where they have access to right now. So he says, don't turn your back on that. Don't refuse God. second bell, really. I didn't get to the last four verses of this book, this chapter. All right, next week is our last class. We will pick up with verse 25 next week and finish the book. Thank you all for your good attention again tonight.